I mean, I think the answer lies in entrepreneurship. It's in figuring out how to satisfy people better than we can satisfy people today. And the only way of doing that is to have as many people as possible basically try their luck and serving others as much as possible.
Welcome to Thinking on Lincoln, the podcast on 13th and Lincoln, talking about things on 23rd and Lincoln. I'm your host, Curtis Shelton, joined as always with my co-host, Ryan Haney, and our producer, Lindsay McSparren, this time via Zoom. Ryan, how are we doing? It's less fun not getting to see your pretty face in person.
Well, I'm sorry about that for you. I'm doing well. Because we have a function tonight, I decided to do the old work from home today. That way since we have casual Fridays, I didn't want to wear the suit all day to work. And then I'm also taking my daughter to the event tonight. And so I didn't want to have to drive home and then drive right back up to work. So this is just a lot easier today to be doing this from home today. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm doing great. I thought, you know, we just had a great conversation with Per Bylin from your alma mater, Oklahoma State. Yeah, turns out there are some intelligent folks at Oklahoma State University.
Would have thought.
I know. It was shocking to me as well. They had to go to Europe to find somebody, but they do exist.
Yeah, no, I think this was a really good episode. It made me honestly super regretful for my undergrad years. I took a bunch of econ classes, obviously, and I never got a chance to study with them. I think it would have been really, not to disparage my other econ professors, but I think it would have been really enjoyable.
Did y'all overlap? Do you know? I've not looked at how long he's
been. Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember hearing his name and those classes. I mean, obviously he's teaching like entrepreneurship classes, which aren't directly tied into the econ major necessarily, but I don't recognize the name. But I was not the most, let's just say that I wasn't super plugged into the staff, and neither was the staff super aware of who I was as well. So I'm not the one to ask.
Yeah. So, you know, just as an introduction, you know, we had Dr. Per Bylin on today to talk about a little more about economics, about entrepreneurship, about his new book, which is called How to Think About the Economy, A Primer. You know, I've said on the podcast before that I normally don't go back and listen to our episodes. I will say last Friday, my daughter had a concert like a choir concert in Tulsa. And she rode back with me and I said, you want to listen to tunes or do you want to listen to a podcast? And she said, let's listen to a podcast. And I was like, okay, what do you want to listen to? She's like, Thinking on Lincoln. And so I was like, that's what I'm talking about. So I did listen to last week's episode, which, if I do say so myself, was a banger episode, and I think this one's good too. It's always funny to me because the episodes that I think are going to be like really great, I think sometimes fall flat a little bit, and the episodes that I think are going to bore people to death, people really like. So, you know, when we had Carl Szabo on and talked about antitrust, you know, I thought, man, this is going to put people to sleep. They're going to hate it. And then people were like, man, that was a great podcast. I don't know why you were so down on it. So hopefully I'm right about this. You know, economics can be kind of dry, but at the same time, you know, I think one of the interesting things about economics as it relates to sort of this Austrian school is that it seems like it's much more tied to our everyday lives. So hopefully people feel that way about this episode.
Yeah, that's been my draw to learning more about this kind of school of thought, I guess, we talked about it a little bit in the episode, but going through school, going through economics classes, my frustration was always with the theories were so cut and dry as if these were proven facts. Whereas Austrian economics takes the approach more so of just like the human nature. They take into account human nature a lot more than I think at least other economic theories and economic schools of thought do, at least in a general sense, which is fine.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, one of the, you know, it seems like one of the fundamental and sort of like, you know, sort of economics 101, at least in the mainstream, it's like one of the assumptions is you assume perfect competition, Right. And that's why we get into all, you know, we didn't get into this on our antitrust episode, but, you know, that's the whole thing with that, you know, people wanting to interfere with the market with respect to antitrust laws, right? Because they think that perfect competition is like this, is this worthwhile goal. And maybe it is a worthwhile goal, but it's just, it doesn't exist. There is no such thing as perfect competition, right? I mean, the market is full of imperfect individuals making decisions based on imperfect information. So, you know, the idea that perfect competition even can exist just doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah, no, that 100%. I feel like, again, I don't know if we use sports too much in this podcast for examples of things.
No, necessarily, you can't use it too much.
It's such a, it is maybe our closest thing to like a true meritocracy that we have. And even in then, you still see exploits. And obviously, there's parity to a degree. But at the same time, you have long run domination from teams. And you have some teams like the Knicks who've been terrible for 20 years, right? And it's just, you'd think that in a very closed circuit of people all operating by very similar rules, that you'd have a lot more parity than you actually do. And even in that, you still don't get it.
Yeah. The important thing to me is that everybody's playing by the same rules. And that in my mind is the role of government, right? To just make sure that everybody is subject to the same rules. And if you are a lot better at playing by those rules, then you're going to excel, right? Which is why, you know, for years, the New England Patriots were just like dominant in football, right? Like they were just, well, I do want to have the caveat about the whole Deflategate thing. I don't know how much of that actually played into their success. It does seem, you know, in the past years, we've seen that it does appear that Tom Brady was a huge factor in their success, because they went from being really, really good to, you know, him leaving and taking another team to the Super Bowl, right? So, I mean, but at the same time, you know, there were teams that passed on him, right? I mean, like,
right.
So, you know, government, the role of government, I think properly understood, is to just enforce the laws that create a level playing field. And not to expect that level playing field will result in level or equal results. Is that too much to ask for?
Oh, you wouldn't think so. I think that's well said. Well, hopefully, I think people enjoy this. You have anything else to add before we get started to the interview?
I don't want to put off the interview too long. But one of the things that Dr. Bylund said is, you know, is something like, and he was not talking about what I'm about to talk about, but it jogged my memory. He said something about like, you know, that's not how government budgets work. People understand how government budgets work. But in fact, as we've seen over the last couple of days, people do not understand how government budgets work. Briefly, we have to get into this because it's just it's a travesty that that people are being lied to, and a lot of people are not understanding it. As people may or may not have seen this week, the new superintendent of public instruction, Ryan Walters, unveiled his education budget. Now, his predecessor, Joy Hofmeister, famous Republican turned Democrat, or the other way around. I don't know that that's really important, but you know, she had her budget, and it was bigger. And it involved, it's my understanding on this part is that it involved a teacher pay raise of, I think, $5,000 for everyone across the board. Everybody gets it. If you are awesome, you get the same a pay increase as someone who is not awesome, right? Hmm. Well, Ryan Walters unveils his budget. It is still a growth in education spending and a massive increase in government spending by any means. It does not include the same increase for teacher pay that his predecessor wanted. It is not an across the board increase. It's a merit based increase. So some people might get an increase in their pay of $2,500, but it's $2,500 to $10,000. So if you're a really good teacher, you might get double what Joy Hoffmeister was going to give you. If you're not a very good teacher, you may not get anything. And if you're, you know, if you're doing well, but maybe not, you know, killing it like some of the others, you might see, you know, $2,500 or $5,000 or whatever, right? It's sort of a sliding scale. At least that's my understanding of it. Also included in his budget, one of the reasons his teacher pay raise was not as big an increase. I mean, that cannot be overstated, right? Like they're right. Both increases. Is that he wants to appropriate $100 million to making sure that we are teaching reading in a way that is scientifically proven to increase reading results. And yet, there are people out there calling this a budget cut, a cut to education, whatever you want to call it. That is not how budgets work. People ought to know better. You know, right. a smaller increase in government spending to common ed is not a budget cut.
Right. And I do think, not to correct you too much here, but just the idea that this is a budget is also just not, I don't know if people are lying about that, but it's not correct. It's a budget request, which some people may sound like semantics, but at the end of the day, it's similar to what the governor's going to put out here in a couple of weeks during a State of the State. He's going to put out his governor's budget book, which is basically a suggestion, which is the same thing as what Ryan Walters is putting out. Every state right. agency submits a budget request saying this is how much money we want to have like. For these various programs. Right. And at the end of the day, no matter what Walters suggests, it's not up to him how much the Department of Education is going to get. It's up to the legislature. So the legislature at the end of session decides they're going to put in more or less than what he decided. You know, they're the ones who ultimately have the power of the purse, and they're the ones who put together the actual budget, regardless. I think people need to understand that.
Right.
Whatever Walters is saying is not set in stone by any means in the first place.
That's correct. I don't think that corrected me so much as it provided further clarity that the superintendent of public instruction cannot cut the budget. I mean, he can ask for it to be cut, which he has not, by the way. He's asking for an increase. It's just not as big an increase as his predecessor, who, by the way, is a Democrat. And so, you know, ultimately the legislature, like you said, is going to come up with the budget. But people are out there. I mean, this is going to be a really fun 4 to 8 years, because if this is how people are starting treating the new State Department of Education, it's just going to be a lot of fun, because it's not hard to see through this lie. It's either a lie or a gross misunderstanding of what's going on.
I definitely think, I would say, yeah, it depends. I would imagine most people who are in the works genuinely maybe don't know. But for those who understand the process, it's hard to imagine that you don't understand the difference between the two.
And if you're a reporter, you should figure it out.
That's your job. Ask questions. Don't assume the person telling you is telling you the truth.
Yeah. So I did feel like, you know, we've got one more episode of the economic stuff, which I love. I think this is great, but stuff is already ramping up. So these intros might be a little longer while we kind of talk about some of the things that are starting to happen as legislative session approaches. Yeah. So, I hate to sort of like divert, but that was just such a, I mean, you know, thank you for coming to my TED talk, I guess is what I'm saying. So
maybe we'll give it a little special episode just to devote to some session, so the session related topics coming up.
Well, and that'll be what the podcast will focus on really from the middle of February through May. So if that's what you like about our podcast, we will be returning to that shortly, but this one's good. And I think our next economics one is going to be good as well. It'll be less, I think, focused on theory and more on sort of practical Oklahoma and state related issues. Mm-hmm. So don't tune us out. Let us finish this. And we will get back to providing updates on what's going on.
And as always, if you don't like it, send me an email.
That's right. That's right. Send Curtis an email.
All right. Hope y'all enjoy.
Okay, we are joined this morning on the podcast by Dr. Per Bylin. Dr. Bylin is a professor at Oklahoma State University here in the state. He's a PhD and a senior fellow, also at the Mises Institute, just like our guest last time, Dr. Salerno, and he's an associate professor of entrepreneurship and a chair in the School of Entrepreneurship there at the Spears School of Business at Oklahoma State University. He's written a number of books, and that's one of the things we want to talk about. You know, our Fears Fellowship passes out these books. I don't know how it's going to go in the future, but in the past we've handed out his book, The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized. And I don't know if we're shifting to changing the book or if we're passing out both of them, but now, one of the books that our Fears Fellows get is his new book, How to Think About the Economy, A Primer. Dr. Bylan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I want to talk a little bit about, probably start with maybe one of your favorite subjects, your new book. I'll be honest with you, I've not finished reading it, but I have read the first couple chapters. You know, it strikes me as kind of an updated version or a slightly different version of Henry Hazlitt's classic Economics in One Lesson. But why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, why you wrote it, who the intended audience is, and you know, if you feel like that was a fair comparison, and you know why or why not?
Yeah, I do think it's fair, and I think it's probably more spot on than you might realize, because the issue that I had, and I guess a lot of other people too, especially in Austrian economics, is that people tend to ask, okay, so where do I start to read? What can I read to get up to date and sort of get started? And there are a bunch of introductory books and things like that you can start with. You obviously shouldn't start with a treatise like Mises' Human Action or something like that. But the question then is, what should you start with? And the typical starting point is Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. The problem with that one is that it really is one lesson. It has a lot of chapters, yes, like 35 or something like that. But the problem is that it's only opportunity cost, right? It's only the trade-off. And it's core to economics, so it's definitely important. And he does it really well, but it doesn't really go beyond that. So after you read that book, yeah, you can sort of apply the opportunity cost reasoning, the seen, the unseen, on the economy, but you can't really do a whole lot more. You don't really know what economics can explain and what we can say about different phenomena and so forth, right? There are some introductory books to Austrian economics. Some of them are published by academic publishing houses, which means they cost, let's put it this way. They are priced so that people with student loans can buy them. Right, so they cost around $100 to $200, something like that. And for an introductory book, that's like a lot of money. And they're also not very easy. So they're introductory, but they're sort of using a lot of lingo and jargon and things like that. So they're not super good. So I've struggled with having this one entry point, especially for a lay audience, that I can recommend to people. And I chatted with Jeff Dyes, the president of the Mises Institute, about this, and he was excited about it too, and saw the same thing, that there's really something missing here. And we talked about how to put it together or where we could find one. And well, then of course, as always in life, if you suggest something, you're tasked with doing it, right? So we talked about it, and I just volunteered, I don't know, but. We agree that we need a primer on Austrian economics, typically Austrian, that is also it covers the whole thing, the whole economy, but it should be short. So the goal was to keep it at less than half the length of Hazlitt's classic, okay. Yet at the same time cover all of economics pretty much, right? And keep it really simple, and of course it's keep it really cheap because it's only $5 to buy it, right? So and I think we sort of managed to keep it or meet all those goals. And when I wrote it, I was really sort of thinking of the target audience as someone's grandma. So the point was writing economics for someone's grandma, so easy, so short that you can actually give this book to your grandma, and you can afford it too. Give it to your grandma, and she can read it in like a day or something, or over the weekend, and actually grasp what is going on, and she will be more economically literate after reading it. That was the goal. I mean, whether I'm successful is for others to say, but that's what I was trying to attain.
Excellent. Well, and I will just add to that, and I would encourage people to go out and buy the $5 physical copy. And maybe this option is not for grandma, but you can actually get the ebook for free at Mises.org. So go out, support Dr. Bylund's work. But, you know, should you have those astronomical student loans we talked about earlier, that is also an option.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, Ron and I talked about this a little bit before you hopped on, how I saw your book is somewhat similar to Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics. It's obviously much, much shorter, and I think a lot more digestible, because Sowell kind of goes into some of the more academic, number heavy type of stuff as well. But I wanted to ask a little bit about, you mentioned the book is about the Austrian economic point of view. And can you, I asked our last guest, Dr. Salerno, a little bit about the differences between the Austrian outlook versus the other kind of economic schools of thought. Can you explain maybe the differences you have with Thomas Sowell's book, as well as just the different thoughts, schools of thought in economics?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this it's really a big question,
right?
So it requires
those are the
history,
only
requires...
those are the only kind of questions we ask on this podcast, is big questions.
Okay. Well, maybe the answer is longer than my primer, so we'll see. But I'll try to keep it short. I mean, Austrian economics was one of the main streams of economics. 100 years ago, it was one of the big three. It was one of the three traditions that started with the marginalist revolution, where economists recognized that, oh, people don't value water itself. They value each unit of water separately, right? So, and the same thing with diamonds or bread or whatever. You don't value the concept or the type of good, but you value each unit. So that's why the first glass of water could be really important to you, and you value it a lot because it will keep you alive. But the 100th glass of water is not very useful, and maybe you don't even find any use for it, so it might even be worthless. Right, and that unleashed a lot of research into pricing and such things that wasn't really possible before. So in that sense, Austrian economics is modern and new. On the other hand, it's not modern and new in sort of the scientific sense that it needs to use math and data and that sort of thing. So it doesn't use the scientific method. I mean, there's something wrong just calling it the scientific method, right? But the classical economists, they were reasoning about the economy, trying to figure out, how does this thing work? So the economy is something. It has an order to it, a structure to it, or it's like a process. It's moving. It has a dynamic. And yeah, we can effect change on this system, but we can't really steer it perfectly, right? It's not our creation explicitly or something that we design. The economy exists in itself. So they were trying to figure that out. Modern economists do not. So Austrian economics is sort of taking the great legacy of the classical economists, which were up to 1870 pretty much, and their reasoning about the economy, how it works and how it is a process, and with the entrepreneur at the center and everything like that, and all the problems involved with capital being in specific goods, such as a train or a toothpick or a hammer and things like that. Not as modern economists, they see it as dollar amounts or dollar values, but that misses the point, because it's not that easy to make hammers out of a train. But if you just treat it as dollar value, then, well, the train is 2 million hammers, and it's very easy to just transition. Well, in the real world, it's really costly and really hard, right? So Austrians recognize this. To take that sort of reasoning, apply marginalism to it, try to figure out what is going on with the economy itself, and does not attempt to predict specific outcomes. So modern economics is sort of deviated from, well, any social science proper, really, by adopting only prediction, trying to be physics in a sense. So they're using math, they're using formalized models, they're using a lot of data, they're trying to predict exact outcomes. But the exact outcomes are are outcomes of human action. So it's a lot of people making all kinds of judgment calls. You can't really put that in a function and then say, oh, this is going to be the exact outcome. That's just impossible. So while students don't try to do that, we can predict in sort of a fuzzy sense that if we make this change to the economy, it will have these kinds of consequences, and it will increase or decrease certain phenomena in magnitude, but we can't say by how much, right? So you can say that Austrian economics is the continuation, the modern version of old style economics. It's an economics that has the entrepreneurship and entrepreneur at the center. It sees the economy as a process. It uses a specific method to produce theory, which is not based in data at all. It's based in logic and logical derivations. It sees capital for the actual things that it is and things like that. That's probably why people are so... they really like the intuition that Austrian economics gives you, because it gives you an intuition for how the thing works and not a specific model to produce a prediction, but you get a good feel for how it works.
Yeah, thanks. And one of the things that I hope that this series of podcasts does for our audience, I mentioned this when Professor Salerno was on last time, is I hope that our listeners who are probably more familiar with people like Sowell and Friedman can realize that there are other, you know, perhaps you might even want to call them more radical free market economists out there doing other work, and that there's going to be some overlap, but there's maybe some gaps in Friedman and Sowell. And you brought up an interesting point. I certainly hope that, you know, you see an increase in book sales because of this podcast, but After reading your book, you talked about not diving in immediately to a treatise, but it's funny to me. I actually came to learn about Austrian economics because I first got into Hayek, because The Road to Serfdom is an incredibly popular book. But when you go on Twitter and you announce on Twitter that you really like Hayek or that you're getting into Hayek, immediately what you know, the Mises folks do is say, oh, well, if you like Hayek, you've got to read Mises. And I contend, and I'm wondering if you agree with me, that actually, I think what people ought to do, what the average person should do, is if they read your book and they're like, oh, I would like to know more, I think a better jumping off point, you know, from an introductory book like yours to a more treatise type book would be Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard, which the Mises Institute has kept much more affordable than what you were talking about earlier. I think I bought a copy for $35 or so, and it's just a massive, massive book. But it's much more approachable to a lay reader than Human Action. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I teach a course on Austrian economics at OSU, and the students get to read all kinds of classics. So they read the Austrians from 1871 and up to now, pretty much. And it's not hard to read Austrian economics because it is text and it is reasoning, right? So it's much easier than reading the math in other schools of thought. But the thing is, they see a huge difference between Rothbard and the others. And part of it is that the others, I mean, they spoke German, and you have translations, and German is a long and complex language. And of course, the old style European scholar, and actually it's the same still with European scholars, they write in a specific way that makes the sentences really long. They like to use a lot of commas and stuff like that, right? Whereas Americans are much more direct and use short sentences, and it's much more about the communication of it. I'm not saying it lacks substance in any sense, but it's a very different way of communicating. And Rothbard is definitely American in that sense. So it's shorter, it's to the point. So the students say, oh, can't we just read Rothbard? Which to me is not really a problem at all. But I think they should get both sides, and they get to read the same type of argument in different ways, which is a good thing.
Now, do you consider yourself to be a European scholar? Because I do not get that. I don't get that sense from your text.
Well, no, not in that sense. I think I was. But the thing is, I had to learn a different way of writing. And part of that is that as soon as you're, when you start writing for the public, it's different, right? Then you need to be much more to the point, and you need to be not use a lot of jargon and things like that. But also writing in the US for US audience is different, because people don't sit, well, I mean, now with the generation thing, with the modern generations, it's different too, because now people will not spend more than 20 seconds on your book, pretty much. So if you have a sentence that takes 15 seconds to read, then you're screwed. But you need to be really, really to the point. And I got a lot of different, I learned in many different ways, but I think Twitter taught me a lot, especially starting with 140 characters, trying to just convey some sort of economic meaning in 140 characters. And back in the day, I mean, then links counted and all this stuff too. So you really just had 140 characters, and that was really, really hard. Of course, now it's 280 and the links don't really count all that much, and all this stuff, that all these changes to the system. But it really forced me to think about what am I trying to say here? What exactly is the point? And Rothbard sort of has this naturally. He was just a very good communicator. When he wrote something, it's easy to follow. Sometimes it's so easy to follow that you read it quickly and you miss the depth of it. And that's something that I discuss with my students in class too, because Rothbard goes through, say, diminishing marginal utility and how consumers see goods and whatnot else. And it's like five pages and then he's done with that. Well, there's a lot of depth there that we have to realize. So it's easy to miss that if it's too on point or too to the point.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a very long text, but he doesn't belabor any points, you know, like older scholars did.
Yeah, and it's also a difference that I've noticed when I've read sort of the old masters of Austrian economics and the newer one. I guess Rothbard could be the newer one. I mean, I think it was born in the mid-20s, 1920s. So it's calling him a newer, younger one. It sounds a little weird. But, I mean, they were talking to different audiences, right? So that when Menger, the founder of the school, talked about subjective value and what makes a good and why is it valuable, he had to start from scratch, right? Saying that, well, you have all these weird views of what it means, but this is what I mean. And it needed to argue every detail of it to get people on board. Now, when we read it, we go like, oh, why is he using so many words for this? Even though he is pretty much to the point, but he's still going through these nuances and everything. Like, if we get that value is subjective, why do you keep talking about this, right? Well, Rothbard, Man, Economy, and State, from early 60s, then people already knew a lot of that stuff. Then even mainstream economics had adopted the subjective value, so he didn't have to talk about what does it actually mean and why is value always subjective and things like that, because the audience would have caught up with at least those points.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work teaching entrepreneurship at OSU. You talked about economics being more of a social science as opposed to things like physics, but I think a lot of people, and maybe people disagree with me, but I think quite a few people see economics and entrepreneurship very differently. They see entrepreneurship more as kind of a creative field, an artistic field, and economics a lot more data-driven, a lot more kind of hard science. Can you explain how those two things are actually very intimately involved and how you got to teaching entrepreneurship at OSU?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the problem there is that economics has moved towards, I mean, it's really embraced its physics envy. So it's really trying to be the physics of the social sciences. So it's all of the stuff learned for 150, 200 years past, they're trying to just go, yeah, the legacy is great, but we have a lot of data, right? Pretty much. And trying to do that. And of course, in their models, if you try to address anything about the economy in a mathematical model, you don't have, just like you said, you don't have any creativity or creation in there. So you can't have an entrepreneur. So Bill Baumol was a scholar, he died a few years ago, who was sort of famous in the mainstream. And he wrote already in 1968 a piece saying that, well, the entrepreneur has been expunged from economic theory. And Joseph Schumpeter, sort of the a prophet of innovation, or whatever you want to call him, also a famous economist, wrote the same thing in the 40s already. Modern economics, he said in 1942 or something, has unfortunately gotten rid of the entrepreneur because it doesn't fit in the models. So when you study economics and you shift the curves back and forth, and then you go to the intermediate level and you realize, oh, the curves are math, and then you you run mathematical manipulations of those functions instead of moving the curves back and forth. There's no space for the entrepreneur at all. There's no space for creating new value or anything like that, or just disrupting the market. What does that mean? Well, try to address that in math. It doesn't fit there. So economics has sort of left entrepreneurship behind. And entrepreneurship has then, in a sense, claimed as a discipline, claimed that space and started out as, just like you said, a very applied field, trying to figure out how the heck do we create value? How do we make sure that the product is worth something and stuff like that, right? So very hands-on, but then realized that we need a theory to explain what the heck is going on too. So that part has been expanding in entrepreneurship. And of course, it's taking part of what economics was before, because an entrepreneur who is not in the economy, what the heck is that? Of course, the entrepreneur is in the economy. And if the entrepreneur is the sort of the change agent, the creator of novelty and more value, well, it should be at the very core of the economy. So I think the two fields, they sort of went their own way, but now they're sort of finding each other again in a sense. Even though I think entrepreneurship scholars are probably more likely to reinvent economics than economists are likely to reintroduce the entrepreneur, unfortunately.
I'm wondering, there are differing definitions of what an entrepreneur is. There's, you know, entrepreneur as risk taker, entrepreneur as, someone who just sort of takes advantage of opportunities as sort of an agent of arbitrage. I'm wondering, what do you feel like the best definition is for an entrepreneur? I mean, I think you brought up Schumpeter, who I think he was I think he was sort of in that arbitrage category, but I don't recall exactly.
Well, the problem is that entrepreneurship is sort of one of those concepts that floats around a little bit and it's hard to pin down. And it's just like you said, there are plenty of different definitions and different theories. Even within Austrian economics, there are different theories. So Mises says that, well, any uncertainty bearing is entrepreneurship. So there's an entrepreneurial element to any action, really, because we can't know exactly what the outcome of our action is going to be. So that uncertainty, that's entrepreneurial. And then, of course, you can take on a whole lot more uncertainty by investing in a really long production structure that will create a product for some faraway customer that will be available in 10 years. And it costs you $1 billion to produce it. Well, that's a lot of uncertainty, right? But what is the distinction between that? I mean, my going to the bathroom has some uncertainty to it. And then in making this $1 billion investment, is there a difference there? So then you have Israel Kirzner, Mises' student, talking about the arbitrage thing, right? How is the exploitation of opportunity? And just basically saw price discrepancies and you can exploit those. But he really excluded uncertainty from his definition. And then you have Schumpeter, who's known for sort of the creative destruction of the entrepreneur. And that he focused completely on just disrupting the economy and sort of the innovation of it. And to me, I think, well, I mean, if you want to explain only how the market sort of finds its way and finds a balance a little bit, and there's a slow and steady progression of it, then you can do the arbitrage and you can do those sort of things. But to me, it's much more interesting to look at the big swings that sort of pushes the economy forward, not step by step by just finding a little more efficient use of resources, but instead figuring out something completely new that has sort of ripple effects throughout the economy. So one example I use a lot, which is becoming dated, unfortunately, but the move to the release of the first iPhone. Before then, everybody had flip phones. The thing was to produce as small phones as possible. I mean, had they continued without the iPhone, first iPhone, the phones would be so small now that we could hardly find them. instead, you had Steve Jobs saying, oh, well, people are looking for small phones. Let's produce a big ass phone that is like the biggest thing they've ever seen. And that doesn't really work well as a phone either, but you can sort of play music on it. And it sort of has a not very good connection to the internet too. And then consumers were like, whoa, that's really cool. And then that became the thing. I mean, everybody has a, almost everybody has a smartphone today, right? And that's the standard now, which means it had effects throughout the economy. Such things as traveling somewhere. You don't buy travel books and stuff like that before you go there because you can, well, you already have it in your hand in your phone anyway, right? And the same thing with paper maps when going on a road trip. It used to be a thing to stop at the welcome centers every time you enter a new state, right? And pick up a map because then you would know how to navigate, right? Now, well, I mean, the welcome center is there because, I don't know what, do they have a vending machine and bathroom in this spot? It's, they probably have paper maps, but who uses those anymore? So you have all these other changes to society just because of this new product that just changed people's behavior. I think that is super interesting because that means that economic growth, it's not just a slow and steady process. It just takes leaps forward, which is, I think is really interesting. And that's where I focus my own work anyway.
Yeah, it seems like entrepreneurs and economists kind of share, they both study, you know, human actions. It's just how they apply that study. You know, economists are more theorizing about like broad human action, like what it means for society as a whole, whereas entrepreneurs are more looking at it to produce either a service or a good based off of, you know, whatever type of actions they see humans taking. Yeah, it's a really interesting thought that you gave there. I wanted to ask a little bit about, again, this is kind of tying into the idea of economics shifting to more of a physics envy a little bit, and how that ties into MMT, modern monetary theory. I know it's something you talked a lot about, at least on Twitter, and how we've gotten to the point where economists are basically trying, I mean, it's not super new, it's been happening for a while, but economists are trying to basically manage the economy as a whole. And this is kind of their new step. It seems like, I don't know if it's as popular as it was maybe a year or two ago because of how crazy inflation has gotten. I think a lot of people have kind of understood money supply a little bit more, but can you explain a little bit what that theory is and the major problems with it?
Yeah, sure. And it, in a sense, it really follows the physics envy, right? That it, not only can you predict the perfect outcome, but of course, if you think that you can predict it, well, then you can change it too. Then you can make something happen. And then that opens up this whole can of worms with, oh, let's just centrally plan everything because entrepreneurs are so silly and wasteful and consumers don't really know what they should consume and all this other nonsense, right? For Austrian economists, it's, well, the whole economy, all of production is taking place for one purpose only. It's to satisfy consumers, whatever the heck they might want at a future point in time. The economy is there trying to satisfy them, right? So if they change their minds, well, sorry, entrepreneurs, you screwed up because you didn't figure out that they were going to change their minds. Or as in the case with the iPhone, that, well, you helped change their minds because you provided something that is much more valuable to them. So they changed their behavior, which of course made other entrepreneurs happy and a lot of entrepreneurs went out of business, that sort of thing. But the prediction thing is, MMT is this, I'm really a little bit troubled by MMT and I'm a little scared of it too, because it's, I think it fits really well the definition of a deepity. So something that when you hear it, you go, whoa, it's like mind blowing. But then as soon as you start scratching a little bit on the surface, you realize that it doesn't actually say anything, right? So, and MMT is just like that. So people who have not really thought about the economy and have really no understanding of it, they listen to MMT and they go, whoa, mind blowing. Is this how it really works? Wow. And then, of course, the first thing that MMTers, they sell the idea with is that, see, we can get a whole lot of stuff for free, which, of course, to a lot of people is very attractive. It's just that any economist will tell you, well, the first rule is scarcity. We can't get everything we want, and nothing is free. So already there, MMTers are anti-economists, really. And the problem there, I think, is that none of the founders or the people who started the theorizing on it like this were economists. And if you look at the people promoting and proposing who are proponents of MMT online, I mean, that's not a very good measure, but they typically have a background in finance or accounting or something like that. Mm. Well, the economy is not finance or accounting. The economy is something else. And especially when we talked about entrepreneurship just a minute ago, how do you fit that into accounting? Well, you don't, because in accounting, you have an equal sign, right? Or you have the right and the left side of accounts and whatnot else. And there's always a balance. So nothing new can enter. And they start with money and just identify. I mean, they observe truly that money today is government fiat. So the government creates money, and then they, from there, they just extrapolate without having any understanding of the economy. So what they're saying is that, well, it looks like everybody's using dollars in the US, which of course is true. That's the money. Government issues the money, also true. So, as Stephanie Kelton, one of the proponents, has said, I think in her TED talk, so unless the government makes the money available, entrepreneurs can't produce profits, which of course is not true, because value is not in dollars, and you can still produce stuff and not make money necessarily if it's the government money, but you can still benefit from trading with others, whatever you produce. So government money is not a precondition for market. That's just silly. This is, and historically, it's just super stupid. But they say that, well, the government needs to spend this money into the economy. So the government prints this new money, they buy resources from people, thereby asset owners have government cash. And then the people can trade with this cash. But why would they accept it? Well, they say, because they will require you to pay taxes using that money. So people will accept dollars from the Fed, pretty much, in payment for their resources, because they know that they will have to pay taxes in dollars. And then they say, well, therefore, everybody uses dollars. And therefore, paying taxes is really redeeming a tax liability, which is complete nonsense, because that's not what redeem means at all. But the issue here is, and I actually had a paper accepted for publication today, which is funny, discussing exactly this, because the problem is, well, even if the government would say, hey, you have to use my funny money here to pay taxes, because I force you to pay taxes. Well, why would anyone sell real resources for these tokens, whatever they are, before they need to pay taxes? And why would they sell them for the tokens to an extent greater than the taxes they expect to pay? And why would anyone else trading with other resource owners say, oh, let's just use these worthless tokens? Those questions are unanswered. So you don't really have a theory. You have the equality, because they say that, well, if you look at the economy as the government and the private sector, then unless the government creates money, there is no money in the private sector. Which means the money that the government spends in the private sector is the money available in the private sector. Yeah, that's the definition of a deepity. It doesn't mean anything at all. But when someone says it and they continue saying that, well, see, so unless the government spends money, entrepreneurs can't make profits in money. You go, whoa, that's right. Yeah, it's right, but it doesn't actually mean anything, because that could be another kind of money.
The folks that listened to our last podcast with Professor Salerno, I think will hopefully be able to see through some of that wordsmithiness. One of the things that I'd like to maybe finish on is, and Twitter has been brought up quite a bit on this podcast, and you're not hurting for followers, but I do want to encourage people to, if they're on the platform, you are at Per Bylund, PerByLund. But you've got this sort of now famous, infamous tweet that from 8 years ago that I want to get into, because I think it's great, and I think probably one of the more interesting things that I, or it's probably one of the things I think people will find the most interesting about all of this. You say, what causes poverty? Nothing. It's the original state, the default and starting point. The real question is, what causes prosperity? And I'd like for you to elaborate on that and why it has received so much pushback. And then also I'd like for you to answer your own question. What causes prosperity?
Yeah, that's a big one. I mean, that's basically the question that economics is trying to answer, right? I mean, if you go back and look at Adam Smith and his groundbreaking tome from 1776, I mean, the title is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. Basically, where the heck does prosperity come from? And we're still trying to figure that out. But I have some ideas that I think are well, since they're my ideas, I think they're good ideas, or I wouldn't adopt them. But so that tweet, I think that why it is so appreciated and so hated at the same time is that I think that the key to learning is usually to ask the right questions. That's much more important usually than answering questions. So if you just ask the correct question, it introduces to you what the answers can be. But if you start, if you ask all these faulty questions, you're going to go on a wild, wild duck chase. What is it called? Whatever.
Goose.
Yeah. It's some kind of bird. Right. So, but the thing is that if you ask the wrong questions, the answers can't help you either. Right. And the question often asked today is, so why are people poor? And can't we afford to make everybody rich? And everybody should have healthcare and stuff like that. Right. And I agree. It would be great if we could make everybody rich and if everybody could have healthcare and everybody could have everything for free. Fantastic. The world is not like that, though. So everything costs something. So we can't make everybody rich. And it's not the case that everybody was rich from the beginning either, as many on the left typically assume or assert that, oh, well, it's because of, very common today is the argument that, well, it's because of the enclosures in England in the 1530s that made us poor. Because apparently before then, if you were a peasant in the 1520s, it was just the Garden of Eden. And everything was fantastic. But then there was this damn count or something who raised a fence. And suddenly you were poor and you were a serf and all the whole world went down the tubes, which is a very strange way of seeing history. But what they're saying is that poverty is created. Well, I mean, someone's individual poverty can be caused by something. For instance, you lose all your money or you make a bad investment. Or you have bad luck, whatever. Of course, people, they make money and they lose money. And some people have simply not made money yet, right? The question is, well, poverty or prosperity, what is the difference? Well, poverty is the absence of wealth. Prosperity is not the absence of wealth, right? It's prosperity is to have wealth. The question then is, where does that come from? And it's not that we have exactly the same amount of wealth today as we did in the Stone Age. That's not the case, right? So we have created a lot of wealth. And that's why we have to ask the question, where does prosperity come from? Because since we are so much richer today, and they're like, what are we now? 8 billion people. And a lot of us are super wealthy compared to most people 100 years ago. Okay, how is that possible? How could that be the case? Well, we have to have created a lot of stuff and machines and whatnot else that we appreciate. So the question must be, how did we do that? How can we do more of it? And how can we help others figure out how to produce more? Right? Because it's not the case that Africa is poor because we are rich. The issue is rather that, well, we are rich. Africa is not rich yet. Why is it taking longer for them? Right? What can we do to help them with information or whatever to become rich? And I think if you're on the left, you want to redistribute whatever is. So you don't want to really think about where wealth comes from and that it's created. Because if you create wealth, the issue then is that, well, redistribution, meaning taking wealth from people who have it, that might put a damper on things in terms of value creation in the future,
mm-hmm.
right? Who the heck is going to create wealth in the future if we take everything right now and just redistribute it and basically give to whoever is not creating wealth from those who are creating wealth? Well, that problem is a huge problem for the left if they would accept that that prosperity is created. So they can't accept that. And that's, I think, why they attack that tweet. And they are so eager to do so as well. And much of it is misinterpretation, too, because they would say, oh, a lot of people are born inheriting wealth. Well, that's not what it means. What it means is, where does wealth itself come from? That's the question I'm asking, right? And that's a question that, yeah, what is the answer to that? Well, I mean, I think the answer lies in entrepreneurship. It's in figuring out how to satisfy people better than we can satisfy people today. And the only way of doing that is to have as many people as possible basically try their luck and serving others as much as possible. And in the market system, there is unbeatable. It's not perfect in any sense, but it's unbeatable because the incentive is that you personally, you and your family, are better off if you make others better off, because that's what exchange means, right? So if you can figure out a way to make consumers really well off producing a good or a service or something, then those consumers are willing to pay you a lot to get what you produce, which means you can make a profit, right? There's no exploitation going on in this relationship. And of course, for you to do that, you have to hire people and you have to pay them enough for them to work for you and not for someone else. So by just trying it as an entrepreneur, you're already creating the jobs, whether or not someone will buy your products, because that's later, right? And if you're really good at figuring out how to satisfy consumers, well, then you will get enough revenue to cover your costs and more. And then you can become wealthy. And then you can do whatever the heck you want with the money. You can invest it or spend it or whatever. But I mean, the incentives align in the market. It's not like when you go through government where, well, the incentives are all screwed up. I mean, we're all aware of how government budgets work, right? When you get allotted a certain amount and, oh, if you run out of money quickly, then obviously you needed it more. So you will get a greater allotment next year, which means the less you economize, the less efficient and effective you are, the more you're going to be rewarded with a bigger budget. And vice versa, if you get an allotment and you're really, really good at what you do, I mean, in government, that's it's unlikely. But let's say you actually manage to meet the goals and you have money left over at the end of the year. What is the result? Well, you're going to get less next year because you didn't need it. So in that type of system, the incentives are screwed up because you reward wastefulness and not producing results. In the market, you don't. In the market, you reward whoever provided the highest value to you.
Yeah, I thought about starting with that question, but I'm glad we ended with it because I don't think there's a better place to end. I mean, Curtis, anything you want to add to that?
No, not at all. I think that's a great the idea of entrepreneurship being how can you serve people better than they're being served today is, I think, a great thought to finish with for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Bylum, thanks so much for being with us. And we really appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you at the Fierce Fellowship later on in March.
Absolutely. I'll be there.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks so much.